Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
Postulated seven souls, top soul, and the first to leave at the moment of death is Ren, the secret name. This corresponds to my director. He directs the film of your life from conception to death. The secret name is the title of your film. When you die, that's where Ren came from.
Time of bodily death is the only reliable. Part 2, Practices and Rituals. Before we transition fully into the practice-oriented portion of this audiobook, I want to say a little bit more about manifestation, how magic works, and how to enhance the efficacy of your practice, whether it be more focused in meditation or centered in ritual and ceremony. This distinction, meditation versus ritual, might not initially seem important, but in my experience, most people gravitate more toward one or the other. I had ample time to explore both when I was on death row, and the practices you'll find here are the result of those nearly 2 decades of intense devotion and experimentation. I encourage you to try out all these techniques for a period of time before deciding what works best for you. I also want to recognize that I often use the words practice and ritual interchangeably, and maybe lean on the former term a little bit more as a general catch-all. However, as you'll find in the chapters to come, what I'm officially labeling as rituals here are typically quite a bit more involved, where practices can often be simple and quick. Attitude and manifestation. Some people think that manifestation is simply a matter of putting enough energy into an imprint on the etheric or astral level of reality until it eventually catches in some way on the physical realm. This can be true, but what most people don't comprehend when doing practical magic is that the thing they're trying to manifest is already theirs, but hasn't been unearthed yet. Manifestation simply means that something has finally been freed from the psychic muck and karma it's been buried under, which is one reason that energy work is so necessary in magic. Whether our efforts at manifestation meet with success or not depends on a number of factors. But one thing I have found to be incredibly important is to adopt a sense of completion after a ritual. We must believe as much as possible that the desired result of our practical magic has already been accomplished. Moving through our day as if it's already a done deal will significantly increase the chances that it is, because magic is always empowered by the faith we put into it. Unfortunately, most people go through life with a profound sense of lack. That poverty mentality carries over into their magic, which makes it a lot more difficult for them to feel as if things are already manifested in the desired way. Interestingly, some evangelical Christians have the right attitude about prayer and manifestation. I once heard a TV preacher refer to what he called living in a state of joyous expectation. He advised his congregation to foster the feeling that their prayers had already been answered, asserting that this would make it far more likely that they would be. This is precisely how magic works. If you're fretting every 5 minutes or so about whether or not your magic is working, the chances are that it isn't, and won't. Basically, all you're doing is pulling your magic back to you over and over again, and so it never gets the chance to do its work on the material plane. It's far more effective to release your expectations and accept that whatever results come your way are a foregone conclusion. When it comes to practical magic, people also don't normally consider that our physical bodies and environments are manifestations of a higher self that created these forms for a particular purpose. For this reason, the old adage, "Be careful what you wish for," is incredibly important to keep in mind when exploring practical magic. These are extremely potent techniques, another reason why following the 90-10 rule I mentioned in the introduction is incredibly important. Sidebar: Chaos Magic and Free Will. The first thing I learned from my practice was that I had orchestrated the patterns of my life in a way that was designed to awaken me to the experience of divinity. I realized that not one single thing in my life was a coincidence or mistake, and there never would be. Instead, it was a methodical production designed to promote maximum growth. Produced by who? And if every experience is somehow mapped out, what about free will? Chaos magicians reject the idea of God and some even assert that the omnipotent creator scenario is merely a parable that refers to the unconscious or subconscious mind. Magic works, therefore, because it triggers changes in the deepest corners of our psyche, and that in turn alters our perception and experience. I think there's truth to this, but I can also see divine orchestration at play in my own life. For example, if I hadn't been falsely accused and put on death row, I never would have had the time or motivation to learn, experiment, and practice magic as I did. In prison, I had no choice. My life depended on it. So, a situation that looks terrible and hellish from the outside is the very thing that led to the most positive results. Quantum physics and magic. Science as it currently stands is a patchwork of scraps of information, and only recently, with the advent of quantum physics, has it offered a cohesive understanding of the mechanics of the universe. Magicians have been exploring this topic for thousands of years, but they typically have lacked a secular vocabulary to describe the process and practice of magic. Now, modern science is beginning to provide that vocabulary. Quantum physics asserts that we exist within a unified matrix of energy, and one of the primary laws of this matrix is quantum entanglement. Quantum entanglement stipulates that all things that have been physically linked remain connected on an energetic level, even if they become separated by vast distances. Prior to the Big Bang, all matter, space, and time were condensed into an infinitely small, dense point. It wasn't just that everything was in direct contact with everything else. Nothing was separate. This means that the atoms composing the molecules involved in the neurotransmitters associated with the thoughts you're having right now as you hear this are in immediate contact with the tiniest particles in stars trillions of light years away. When it comes right down to it, we are all stars, a basic aspect of reality that underlies many of the forthcoming practices. Sidebar. As above, so below. As within, so without. As above, so below. As within, so without. I believe these to be the greatest and most profound words ever uttered in the history of magic. They're a blueprint of how the universe is constructed, but also an operator's manual. Concise instructions on how to manifest our desires. Everything we witness in the physical world is also mirrored in the energetic or astral realm, the subtler planes of existence studied by magicians and quantum theorists alike. The matter and space that compose us are entangled on a quantum level with the matter and space of everything else that can be said to exist. One implication of this is that by causing a change in ourselves, we also cause a change in the remainder of the external universe. A truism put to the test by magicians for thousands of years, and more recently by the World Peace Group in their Super Radiant studies that examine the tangible effects of group meditation on greater society. In short, what the World Peace Group documented is that war-related deaths and violent crime rates dropped, even when the experiment was conducted multiple times and other factors were statistically controlled. They also found that the positive effects increased dramatically the more trained meditators there were involved in the experiment. Experimentation. I'm not a traditional magician by any means. If you've read High Magic, you're already aware of the importance I place on finding your own way with these practices. When I was exploring practical magic on death row, I originally believed that you had to perform the daily rituals by the book. About a year or so into it, however, I gradually began to test how much time and energy to put into something to make it stronger and more effective. I made certain tweaks to get better results and took extensive records of my work. I encourage you to do the same, because keeping track of your alterations to the traditional techniques is essential to a magician's learning process. The first important change I made was in the amount of time I put into each exercise. For example, after you memorize the basics, the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, the LBRP, can be completed in about 5 minutes. I first extended this to 20 or 30 minutes, mostly by increasing the number of inhalations when tracing the pentagrams around me. But I also spent more time visualizing the pentagrams flaming around me in each of the four cardinal directions, seeing them grow brighter and brighter each time I inhaled. Then I tried the same type of extension when invoking the archangels, not rushing the visualizations, but really taking my time, vibrating their names. Right away, I found that it made their presence a lot more tangible. The main thing I came to understand is that finishing a particular ritual isn't the end goal. When I made each step as strong as possible, I began to see greater benefit from what I considered to be the simplest of techniques. I quickly found out that magic is like anything else. You get out of it what you put into it. For this reason, a devoted beginner can see better results than a stickler magician who's been practicing for years and years. That said, I'll emphasize again how important it is to decrease your attachment to results. Just focus on performing each step as sincerely and thoroughly as possible, and try to forget about the outcomes you want to happen. Magical tools and implements. Experimentation also comes into play when it comes to the external forms of your practice. When I was in prison, I had no choice but to employ what some call the empty hand technique. That is, magic without the tools and implements that most apprentices use from day one. For example, wands, incense, candles, pictures, and so on. When you follow the traditional approach, you accumulate a lot of props over the years, and for the longest time, that's how I thought of these things, as mere props. A friend of mine recently told me that he was having trouble with his practice. "I want to believe in magic," he said, "but I just can't seem to make the leap from wanting to believe to actually believing." I think this struggle is common for most people. They have trouble convincing the psyche that they're actually performing magic. For these people, tools can be incredibly important. The implements create a type of distraction that keeps their conscious mind occupied while they actively train their unconscious to respond positively to the prop. Eventually, whatever tools they're using contribute to the belief that they're actually doing magic. That said, if you can't perform magic without tools, it can be quite limiting. Imagine being a Buddhist who can only practice meditation if they have handy their favorite cushion. I didn't have a cushion on death row, and I didn't have any wands or candles. If I had waited to have these things, I never would have survived in there. There were times when I would see the guards torturing some poor clown down the row, and I knew it was only a matter of minutes before they got to me. I had to learn to calm and center myself and start invoking angels and archangels in situations where fear was so thick in the air you could barely breathe. This is the atmosphere that led me to feel strongly that a magician should be able to be dropped off naked in a jungle on the other side of the world and still be able to perform incredibly powerful magic. I've only recently started using tools. Specifically, I've collected a wand for banishing, a wand for invoking, yet another wand to direct energy when I'm circumambulating, a chalice to represent the element of water, and, my latest obsession, lots of incense. I burn frankincense and eat the resin regularly, collecting the ashes in a silver chalice that's accumulating energy on my shrine. When the chalice gets full, I plan to take it to Central Park and scatter the ashes so that they become part of the earth here. I want people to interact with that energy and experience the protection, guidance, and illumination of the practices associated with the frankincense I've employed in my rituals. In similar fashion, my wands will eventually dissolve into smaller components and bless the earth with all the energy and love they've accumulated over the years. Traditionally, magicians are supposed to craft their own tools, especially wands. Before employing what's called the rainbow wand for invocations, for example, the magician is instructed to shape the wand, paint it, and then go through the process of consecrating and blessing it with all 12 zodiacal energies. What's actually happening in this process is that a magician is customizing their impact on the universe. For this reason, I've started to get more excited about magical implements, because they're assisting me in my goal to bring as much divine light to this plane as possible. I now see using physical objects, art pieces, and all sorts of magical tools as means of sending massive amounts of divine energy into the collective unconscious of all humanity. Charging my wand is just another way of working to awaken all sentient beings. I'm also employing more tools such as herbs, stones, blessed water, and crystals. I plan on leaving energized pieces of amethyst and quartz throughout the city for people to find. My intention is to raise the vibration of consciousness with each object as much as I possibly can. I find myself being pulled more and more toward alchemy as well, specifically in the form of tinctures and spagyrics, alcohol and herb mixtures that have been charged with energy. For example, right now I'm working on a tincture to embody the planetary energy of the sun, the energy of health, vitality, victory, success, and happiness. Over the next month, as the frankincense resin slowly dissolves in alcohol, I'll perform an entire soul invocation ritual, complete with the appropriate archangels and angels. I'll circumambulate the temple hundreds of times, build up as much chi as possible, then push it all into the tincture. It takes about 3 hours to do the entire exercise. After a month of daily practice, all I have to do is place a few drops of that tincture under my tongue and swallow while focusing on a particular intention. The point is that anyone can charge a talisman or tool for their own purposes and use it to affect others. Someone who has no experience with magic at all could use them as easily as someone with a lifetime of practice under their belt. For example, since happiness is one of the qualities associated with the energy of the sun, I could place a couple of drops of the tincture I'm talking about under my tongue, or in a friend's cup of tea. It might help to hold the intention of happiness in my mind while doing so, but the energy I've placed into the tincture works whether or not my friend is conscious of my original intention. Your altar. Finally, I want to say a little bit about how to personalize your altar. Although having an altar isn't necessary, some people like to have one in the center of the space where they prefer to perform their regular practices of magic. In traditional ceremonial magic, altars are quite plain, just a black square of some type. That color and shape are representative of the material world, so employing them in your magic helps your manifestation efforts on the physical plane. In fact, to this day, I still use a black square. As I've encouraged you to do elsewhere, please find what works best for you. If you want to use an altar, it could be a desk, a folding card table, a tapestry or cloth of some sort, or anything else you feel connected to. Just make sure that whatever it is fits the space where you want to do your magic, and that your space isn't too cluttered to work in. Mine just holds my regular tools. The wands and chalice I mentioned earlier, a pinnacle, and an incense burner. Wherever you place your altar, as well as what you put upon it, will become saturated with the energy of your magic over time. I recommend keeping this in mind when deciding where to situate your altar at home. Chapter 5. Mind Training, Mindfulness, and Meditation. Often when people hear the words mindfulness and meditation, they automatically start thinking about Eastern practices that seem boring and have very little to do with the exciting rituals involved with ceremonial magic. In actuality, meditation and mind training are critically important to your development as a magician. A ritual's success depends on them. The magician and author John Michael Greer once said that everyone he knows who has made any real progress in magic has also had a background in some form of meditation. Additionally, in traditional magic, magicians are expected to familiarize themselves with different meditative states and attain the ability to enter them effortlessly. Even beginning practitioners of magic need to be able to narrow their focus and concentrate in the middle of whatever chaos is happening around them. Doing so can make all the difference when it comes to the efficacy of your magic. Meditation also has the benefit of helping you let go of expectations in your practice. Expectations that can lead to a lot of needless doubt and impatience. I've practiced meditation for about half my life now. Traditional Zazen sitting meditation, working with koans, energy circulation, you name it. Every type of meditation has its own benefits, but the form of meditation I've experienced the most results from is what I call prison cell meditation. It's a shortcut to enter a state of single-pointed concentration, transcend the self, and merge with the divine. I practice this meditation every time I'm alone and have a few moments to spare, such as when I'm traveling on the subway or going to the gym. The more I practice it, the more powerful and noticeable its effects are on my psyche. I first came across some version of the following in the mystical Kabbalah by the magician Dion Fortune. Practice. Prison cell meditation. Imagine that you're standing in the middle of the floor of a prison cell. Around you are solid concrete walls and a solid steel door. The only window is a small slit on the back wall of your cell, but it's so high up above your head that you can't see out of it unless you grip the ledge and haul yourself up with sheer brute strength. Imagine that you pull yourself up there by your fingertips, actually feeling what it would be like. The muscles in your hands, forearms, and biceps all activated and getting more exhausted by the second. The rough texture of the wall scraping your belly and thighs as you struggle to ascend. The cold steel of the window bars around your hands. When you finally pull yourself up above the ledge, you're nearly blinded by a brilliant light from the outside. It's the light of creation, and it bursts into the window and makes everything disappear. There's only the light. No prison cell, no window, and no you. Nothing exists anymore but infinite light. That's the meditation. Just like the pull-up or chin-up you're imagining yourself doing, one repetition is probably not enough to do much. There aren't any rules as to how many times you should visualize yourself doing this, but I think 10 reps is a good start. And when that becomes easy, try working your way up to 100 times. When you get truly proficient at it, you'll notice a peculiar sensation. As you imagine the light obliterating everything, including you, you'll start to feel as if you've been cast back into your own body, gently yet forcefully. You'll also experience a temporary state of being grounded in the present moment, in your physical form, with no stray thoughts whatsoever. Mindfulness has been increasing in popularity for the last decade or so, and people apply it in the context of just about anything these days. Golf, cooking, running, tennis, parenting, and so on. Originating thousands of years ago in Eastern traditions, namely Buddhism and Hinduism and their predecessors, mindfulness is a form of meditation that refers to the act of bringing our attention back to the present moment over and over again. For those who haven't practiced mindfulness, it can sound incredibly easy or insignificant, but most people who give it a try find it a lot more difficult and rewarding than my description makes it sound. One reason that mindfulness has become widespread is its documented benefits for body and mind. There's a ton of literature out there, thousands of studies now, on how and why it improves brain chemistry and reduces stress, so I won't go into the science behind why mindfulness is so effective. I'd like to give you my own take, however, because it might be useful to you later on when it comes to the advanced techniques. Sidebar. Everything is made of energy. Everything that is made of energy has a vibrational frequency, and everything is made of energy. People, places, things, even consciousness. Different energies have different vibrational rates. Our consciousness is only capable of interacting with energies close to our own. This is why sports fans tend to hang out with one another. People of a given political party don't typically interact with those who belong to others. And people in general stay within exclusive social circles. If those we come in contact with aren't resonating at the same frequency as we are, they usually pass from our lives fairly quickly. Because everything is made of energy, including our thoughts, and magic is about shaping and using energy, then it follows that we'd want to be more aware of that energy and the ways in which it manifests. Unfortunately, our minds are rarely fully focused on what we're doing or experiencing, especially in today's world. Instead, our consciousness jumps from thought to thought, device to device. It moves from past events to future hopes in the blink of an eye, daydreaming, fantasizing, worrying, and so on. Every time we aren't fully engaged in the present moment, energy is escaping from our aura. We are unconsciously discharging it into manifesting life situations we probably never wanted in the first place. For example, when we constantly go over worries in our head, what we're actually doing is feeding energy into creating situations that will just end up causing us more worry. Thankfully, not every thought and emotion we feed energy into manifest in the physical world. But even so, that energy is wasted when it could otherwise be used to create the life we want or fuel our spiritual growth. Mindfulness helps us cultivate the ability to send our energy where we want it to go, as well as refrain from letting it manifest situations and experiences we don't want. I often repeat the adage, where attention goes, energy flows. We want our attention to support our growth and progress, not detract from it. When our minds are full of what we're doing right now, how we're feeling and what we're thinking in this moment, then we can be fully present and create a feedback loop that sustains us, as opposed to sending our energy out into whatever random thought and fear happens to be crossing our minds. Practice. Zazen. Zazen is the simplest mindfulness practice I know of. For me, it's also been the most difficult. To practice the traditional Japanese form, put a cushion on the floor and kneel on the cushion with your butt touching your heels. Rest your hands in your lap with palms up, one hand on top of the other, with your thumbs touching, almost as if you were holding a giant egg. Keep your eyes open, but gently so, and focus on the floor a couple of feet in front of you. There shouldn't be anything between you and the floor to distract you. Lastly, try not to move, unless, of course, there's some kind of emergency. Just sit up straight and be as still as possible until the session is over. Now here's the hard part. Pay attention. Pay attention to your body when it starts to hurt, because it will start to hurt. Pay attention to your thoughts when they happen, because plenty of thoughts are going to happen. Pay attention to your breath as the air comes in and out of your body. That will hopefully happen a lot too. Actually, the hardest part isn't paying attention. It's paying attention without making judgment calls. This type of meditation isn't about getting it right, but rather witnessing whatever happens without making more stories about whatever's happening. So, just pay attention and experience whatever comes up and do your best to come back to the present moment over and over again. It's harder to do this practice when you first start out. With all the aches and pains and strange thoughts that seem to come out of nowhere, it might even seem impossible. With that in mind, just start with 5 minutes or so until you get the hang of it. When 5 minutes seems workable, try 10. Then maybe 5 extra minutes a week, until you work your way up to a half hour or so. Ceremonial magic and the present moment. Traditional forms of meditation aren't for everyone. I practiced Zazen for years and never experienced a sense of the present moment. But the visualizations and breathwork involved with angelic invocations brought me there seemingly right away. Then again, maybe the time I devoted to my sitting practice somehow prepared me for the meditations involved in ceremonial magic. Like I said before, all practice is beneficial in its own way. And if you actually put the time in, you'll find out what works best for you. The first time I noticed awareness as a benefit of the invocations was on a day when Lori was scheduled to visit me in prison. I was in my cell getting ready to walk down to the visitation room, and as I was sitting on the edge of my bunk, leaning over to put my shoes on, something felt different about the whole experience. I suddenly realized that I was right there, completely in the present moment. I wasn't lacing up my shoes and thinking about something else. I wasn't standing up and traveling somewhere else in my mind. I was exactly right where I was, in my cell, and attentive to every detail of my actions. If you haven't experienced something like this before, it might sound like no big deal, but I personally found it to be incredibly profound. That was the moment I realized just how much I'd been hijacked by my own ego. Everything the ego does and encourages us to think and feel jettisons us from the present moment like a missile. Our bodies go through the motions. Our minds jump around like sugar-fueled children. The present moment is poison to the ego, or the cure, depending on your point of view. Because when we're attentive to right here, right now, there's no room for anything else. No wanting the weather to be different, no judging ourselves for not being good enough meditators, no complaining that our partner left the sink full of dishes. Everything is just as it is, and we're just as we are, right there with it. By contrast, the ego can only dwell in the past or the future. It tries to convince us that we're an amalgamation of previous experiences, relationships, dramas, victories, tragedies, and so on. It constantly projects itself into future scenarios of its own creation, where it plays out endless hopes, fears, and expectations. It has to do this constantly because this is the only way it can assure itself it will survive. For this reason, it will do anything it can to keep us from experiencing the now. Practice. Noticing the strategies of the ego. Find a comfortable spot and sit, stand, or lie there for a couple of minutes. Try to pay attention only to what's happening right now. What your skin feels like. The touch of your breath as it enters and exits your body. The temperature of the air around you. The sounds you hear outside your window, and so on. See what thoughts come to mind as you do this. Don't try to stop your mind from doing what it does, and don't resist whatever the ego is going to throw at you. The point is to simply notice it. Are you thinking about what you're going to eat for dinner? Do you keep remembering something that happened to you yesterday? Do judgments of some sort arise? Whatever it is, just notice it. If nothing comes up in a couple of minutes, try a longer period of time. Eventually, the ego will present something interesting enough to remove you from the present moment entirely, often so skillfully that you won't even notice it at first. The entire reason that we're born into the material realm is to experience it. That seems like a common sense thing to say, but under the influence of the ego, we behave as if we want to be anywhere else but here. One of the main reasons that life can seem so difficult is because we're more invested in resisting it than we are in living it. We fight against our experience constantly, and most people live their entire lives without ever truly experiencing much of it at all. Life gives us situation after situation, inviting us to participate and truly experience each one. And the ego responds by convincing us that things have to be different. That if they were only different, we'd be happy, more fulfilled, safe, relaxed, and so on. Unfortunately, the more we resist, the harder life becomes. That's because the energy we're meant to expend on experiencing the physical realm is going toward unconsciously creating situations that will make it even more difficult to avoid the physical realm. Think about the negative effects that result from any addiction to alcohol, drugs of any type, social media, etc., and you'll see this immediately to be true. If we move in the other direction, however, that is, if we become more invested in being awake and present in the moment, life tends to become more interesting, easeful, and poignant. It isn't that life will automatically become brilliant and special at every turn, but I can say from personal experience that if you're more present, the universe and your higher self won't be so interested in throwing hardships at you at every turn. Buddhist traditions teach that an untrained and unfocused mind produces dukkha, a kind of cyclical energy that keeps us trapped in suffering. Some ceremonial magicians teach that dukkha has a type of intelligence behind it called karanzan, sometimes referred to as the dweller in the abyss, or the demon of dispersion. In some ways, Karanzan is the opposite of an angelic intelligence, and it's Karanzan that stands between us and enlightenment. When the dispersing aspects of this intelligence are highlighted, we can see how it operates much like the ego, doing anything it can to keep us from achieving spiritual awakening, no matter what we call it. Practice. Archangel meditation. This is a short meditation practice to call up the blessings of different archangels without having to do more elaborate practices, such as the LBRP. I recommend beginning with just one archangel and eventually working your way up to six. Let's say you want to add more growth and wealth to your life. I'd recommend doing this meditation with Zadkiel, the Archangel of Hesed. As you walk around throughout the day, practice paying attention to what you're doing while simultaneously invoking your chosen archangel. If you're sitting at a desk at work, for example, occasionally visualize the archangel expanding in front of you while you inhale. Then exhale and do the same after every visualization to follow. Then inhale while you imagine the archangel growing incredibly large behind you. Then do the same for your right side, your left, above, and finally below you. When you've gone through this entire sequence, imagine that you're encased in a sphere of the archangel you've invoked. Try doing this once every half hour or so. After you get comfortable using one archangel, try two. Eventually, work your way up to six, for example, those described in Chapter 1. The ultimate goal of this exercise is to be able to do it no matter what you're doing during the day. A meditation master would be able to do this in the middle of an intense conversation without anyone knowing it. This is an excellent practice to train your mind and begin to focus your thoughts upward toward a higher frequency, so to speak. Instead of allowing your consciousness to run amok from one fear or preoccupation to another, you're training your mind upon a divine focus and absorbing the energy associated with archangels in the process. Anxiety, faith, and fear. Through my own practice, I've come to believe that the greatest detriment to our own development is the downward spiral of fear into which we habitually throw ourselves. Modern science is just now beginning to discover and describe the connections between our thought processes and the physical world. Simply put, our thoughts can either improve or harm our physical forms. Anxious or fear-based thoughts are associated with chemicals in our bloodstream that lead to anything from weight gain and high blood pressure to even illnesses such as shingles. Thoughts of happiness and love, on the other hand, are associated with chemicals that promote feelings of well-being, increased immune function, and so on. I know this from my firsthand experience on death row, especially during my final week, in which I was overwhelmed by stress and fear and suffered terrible nausea and canker sores as a result, an experience I refer to in Chapter 4 of High Magic. This is why some form of mind training or meditation is so important to the magician. It helps us surface those thoughts that are detrimental, become aware of our habitual cognitive patterns, and establish ways of thinking that actually promote what we want out of life. Don't get me wrong, the macho, stereotypical American male, no-fear approach to life is the furthest thing from what I'm talking about, mainly because it doesn't work. And in fact, tends to backfire. We simply can't banish our fear by forceful means. When we try to white-knuckle it and battle fear head-on, all we're doing is placing more attention on it and helping it grow in strength. We're simply feeding it more energy, thereby assisting it in consuming even more of our thoughts. Of course, fear goes by many names: anxiety, worry, regret, despair, anger, stress, doubt, and all of us have our own particular way of expressing its fundamental energy. Regardless what we call it, pretty much every unpleasant internal state we experience can be traced back to fear in one way or another. And the only effective way to overcome it is to become aware of its lies and disengage entirely. We do that by employing mindfulness and shifting the focus of our attention toward thoughts grounded in ease, comfort, and love. Doing so, we're able to generate a whole new set of chemicals and positive energy that will bring about changes we actually want in our lives. Practice. Look up. No one has ever lived a positive, happy, fulfilled life while at the same time staring down into the muck and wallowing in their negative thoughts. This is one reason why the cathedrals of old were built with high, arching ceilings. It invited people to look upward and assumed that posture tends to have a positive effect on our thinking. Try it out for yourself. The next time you catch yourself feeling depressed or simply bummed out, pay attention to your posture. As it turns out, the saying, "keep your chin up," isn't just an empty suggestion. Aligning your spine and lifting your gaze is often the first step to steering your thoughts in a preferable direction. Some people think that the opposite of faith is disbelief, but I believe that the real opposite of faith is fear. When you have faith in something or someone, you feed energy in the direction of all the things you want out of life, helping those things manifest in the physical realm. When you're trapped in fear, however, all of your energy focuses on the things you don't want out of life. You fixate on the things you hope won't happen and obsess over them, which tends to make things worse. So, faith and fear are just different means of directing and focusing our energy. With mindfulness, we can become more conscious of where our thoughts dwell and therefore make better choices rather than mindlessly reacting to the world out of fear. Sidebar: spiritual bypassing. Many people who embark upon a spiritual path fall prey to something called spiritual bypassing. One insidious way that spiritual bypassing takes shape is when people begin to believe that some emotional states are inherently more spiritual than others, which causes them to suppress their experience of fear, or just pretend it isn't there in the first place. Again, this isn't the type of response to fear I'm talking about. Nothing good comes from suppressing emotional energy. It simply manifests in unconscious ways, often in the form of health problems such as heart conditions and cancer. Ignoring fear doesn't cause it to dwindle or cease to exist in the slightest. Meditate. Watch what's going on in your mind. See it for what it is, and steer your thoughts as gently as possible in a more beneficial direction. Vibration. One last thing before we get into the basic practices. You hear people talk about vibration a great deal in magic. For our purposes here, all it essentially means is that when we have a low vibratory rate, it can feel quite unpleasant because the flow of divine energy into our aura is being restricted in some way. Your first clue that this is happening is that you'll feel bad emotionally. Stressed out, anxious, angry, impatient, jealous, and so on. Again, this is where meditation comes in handy, because most of the time we're not even aware that we're feeling terrible, or why. As I've mentioned elsewhere, countless studies indicate that negative emotional states can contribute to everything from weight gain to heart attacks. Nobody needs that, especially if you're trying to learn and practice high magic. Keep in mind that our emotions aren't what cause low vibrational rates. They're simply signals the body sends to warn us that our frequency is dropping. Emotions are the result of our thinking. Anytime you find yourself feeling sadness, it's an indication that you're engaging in thoughts that carry the vibratory rate we equate with sadness. On the other hand, if you're happy or experiencing joy, then your thoughts have been centered on love in some way, for yourself, for others, for the divine, etc. And the emotion of happiness is an indication that your thoughts are in alignment with things of a higher vibrational rate. Practice. Take care of your environment. Our immediate surroundings influence our thoughts and moods, both directly and indirectly. I like to collect beautiful objects, magical implements and paintings mostly, and have found that they enrich the way I feel. Filling your home with uplifting and sensual objects will tend to lift your spirits and increase your vibrational rate. Anytime you find yourself feeling unpleasant emotions, you can train your mind to become aware of the thoughts that gave birth to them, so that you can alter them in order to experience something different. To keep track of your thoughts, all you have to do is pay attention to your feelings.
Thank you.
Velocity Child. And every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion and magical foray, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.